You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 7th of March 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One here in London with me, Emma Nelson. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we discuss the perennially explosive issue of immigration, a subject that's hit the headlines this week like never before. We'll wonder if we're coming or if we're going. Also ahead, we'll examine whether North Korea's threat to carry out a preemptive nuclear strike is enough to have a scuttling for the bunker.
It does sound as if they go further than past sanctions. If the North Koreans are cross now, they're going to go ballistic. I hope that's only a metaphor when the actual resolution goes through.
And we talk to the organisers of an art fair who believe culture shouldn't come accompanied by a hefty price tag, and we enjoy a light lunch, courtesy of the Financial Times.
When we had the idea of doing this as a book, I thought it was a dreadful idea. I thought that the whole business of, you know, newspapers is it's transient. It's not pretending to be anything more than that. And so why on earth would you want to read an interview from 1996, for God's sake?
That was the FT's Lucy Kellaway there. All that, plus we'll play you some great music too. That's all to come here in the next hour here on Midori House on Monocle 24. But first, let's catch up on the news headlines with Paul Osborne.
The running mate of a leading candidate to be Kenya's next president says the election has been rigged. More than 1,000 people died in violence after the last vote when Raila Odinga claimed he'd been robbed of victory. Mr. Odinga, now Kenya's prime minister, is standing again, but his running mate Kalonzo Musyoka says the results have been doctored. That claim has been rejected by Isaac Hassan, the head of the independent commission overseeing the vote.
There's no room to doctor the results whatsoever by any election official. And if any election official aids or abets election malpractice, including the stealing of election results, that election official bears personal criminal liability.
The UN Security Council has agreed new sanctions against North Korea after it carried out another nuclear test. The fourth set of sanctions targets cash transfers and the activities of North Korean diplomats. The Security Council unanimously backed the move, and the US ambassador to the UN, Susan Rice, says that should send a clear message.
North Korea will achieve nothing by continued threats and provocations. These will only further isolate the country and its people and undermine international efforts to promote peace and stability in Northeast Asia.
Earlier, North Korea said it reserved the right to launch a preemptive nuclear strike against nations it described as aggressors. Silvio Berlusconi has been sentenced to a year in prison after being convicted over a wiretap. But the former Italian prime minister remains a free man, as he's likely to launch an appeal. Mr. Berlusconi faces two more trials. In one, he's challenging a conviction for tax fraud. In the other, he denies paying for sex with an underage girl. He also remains the leader of Italy's centre-right bloc, which did better than some polls predicted in last month's election. A dancer from Russia's Bolshoi Ballet has said the acid attack on its artistic director was a mistake. Pavel Dmitrichenko is accused of masterminding the attack on Sergei Filin, who's had surgery in Germany to try to save his sight. The attack followed a period of infighting within the Bolshoi. The detective who was put in charge of the investigation into Oscar Pistorius has resigned from the South African police force. Hilton Butter was removed from the case when it emerged he was facing charges of attempted murder. Oscar Pistorius denies murdering his girlfriend, Riva Steenkamp, insisting he mistook her for an intruder. A video has emerged which reportedly shows 20 Filipinos who've been kidnapped on the Israeli-Syrian border. They were working for a UN body which monitors the border. A Syrian rebel faction calling itself the Martyrs of Yarmouk says it sees them. A wildlife conservation conference in Bangkok has failed to agree a ban on the international trade in polar bears. Campaigners say that, coupled with climate change, the hunting of polar bears for their fur could see their numbers fall by two-thirds over the next 50 years. But Canada's Arctic Inuit community say banning the trade would do little to protect the creatures. Terry Adler, the head of Canada's main Inuit group, was at the talks.
It's food on the table for us. We don't have cows, we don't have chickens, we don't have pigs. We rely on the seal, we rely on the polar bear, the walrus. So it's in our best interest to manage the wildlife so that it's there for future generations.
That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Paul Osborne there. The time is 5 minutes past the hour. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Das ist Monocle 24.
Hong Kong,
Zurich,
London.
This is Monocle 24.
Now, the issue of immigration has always been and perhaps always will be one of the most politically polarising issues. Elections are won and lost on the subject, and as we've seen in the last 5 years, in times of financial upheaval, it rises to the forefront of debate and the rhetoric gets ramped up. Just this week alone in the United Kingdom, an anti-immigration party, UKIP, behaved like the winners in a local election in which they came second. The Home Secretary, Theresa May, was described as being certifiably mad by critics of her plans to impose visa restrictions on Brazilians. And only today, Thursday, the opposition put forward plans for an overhaul of the UK's immigration policy within Europe. Well, in a moment, we'll be talking to our foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield, for an overview. But first, let's see how other countries are doing. We'll be heading to Canada and Denmark in just a moment. But let's cross first to the United States, where Aisha Spears joins us from our bureau in New York. Aisha, this obviously has been at the absolute forefront of political debate ever since Barack Obama put forth some quite fundamental changes to immigration in the United States.
Indeed. So immigration was a hot issue for the election last year. You know, we can't forget people like Herman Cain suggesting building a moat to separate the US and Mexico. And it's an even hotter issue now as Republicans realise they need to get a handle on it in order to have a chance in 2016. So currently, the way it stands is there's an eight-person bipartisan committee in the Senate, including people like John McCain and Marco Rubio from the Republicans, who are trying to draft a resolution. And they hope to have legislation drafted by this March and a vote before the August recess, which in some way paves a path to citizenship, which is really the big kind of call to arms for people in immigration reform. They want to strengthen the Mexican border, allow guest worker visas, and provide a status to path for both people who came to the US as children and as adults in order to give them either citizenship or residency. So over the next couple of months, and indeed this month, we'll see some changes towards that.
Quite a lot of people have criticised the fact that Obama has made such a personal effort to bring immigration reform forwards. They've been saying that the fact that Obama has personally sort of led the way will in fact mean that any kind of efforts to push immigration reform through could be just rejected by the Republicans on the basis that it is Obama's idea.
Indeed. So last month, there was a leak of a backup plan that Obama and the White House seem to be working on in case this bipartisan committee don't really do what they're supposed to do. Some people are saying that it was leaked in order for the Republicans to really hurry up and not allow whatever resolve happens to be seen as an Obama push. That what they're actually suggesting, both in the White House and through this bipartisan committee, is quite similar. What they want to do in terms of these paths to citizenship, it's now a political game of who seemed to be doing more, especially as, you know, there's a huge power in the Hispanic and Asian American vote, and obviously they're much more tied into this issue of illegal immigrants than the kind of Caucasian current majority of the US voters.
In New York, Aisha Spears, thank you very much indeed for joining us. We can cross now to Denmark, where Michael Booth joins us. Michael, we've just been hearing about proposals to reform the United States immigration process fundamentally. Denmark itself has been through the process of reform in the last 12 months alone, hasn't it?
Yeah, not just the last 12 months, but the last decade, actually. It's undergone extreme reform from basically an open-door policy, which caused many problems and led to the rise of a far-right party called Dansk Folkeparti, the Danish People's Party, who came to power and had a major say in the coalition government for about 10 years and helped introduce some quite draconian laws about integration. And they basically stopped immigration from non-Western countries. But in the last year or so, we've had a left-wing government which has repealed some of those integration laws. But it's not such an issue in Denmark anymore. Immigration is not such an issue. We have more pressing concerns. the economy, for one.
That it's unusual, though, because when you mention that people have more pressing concerns, what seems to happen is that the fewer jobs available, the more loudly heard the anti-grim immigration voice is. Is that the case in Denmark?
Yeah, exactly. That's been the normal pattern, hasn't it, over the last 30, 40 years, that when times are hard and unemployment is high, people direct their fire on the immigrants. That's not happening so much in Denmark, partly because the doors were closed about 10 years ago, quite firmly, to non-skilled immigrants and refugees, compared to what happened in Sweden, where the doors have remained open and up to 30% of the Swedish population was not born in Sweden, and that's causing all sorts of problems there. The Danes clamped down, very controversially, but the result is that 10 years on, I was speaking to the former foreign minister who was in charge of the integration policy for many years, Bertel Haarder, the other day, and he said, we had an open-door policy, a large public sector that supported people who came to this country. We've closed that now. We have only access for skilled workers, and that has changed perception in Denmark as well. People are more aware of what immigrants contribute to Danish society. And though the extreme right-wing party, the Dansk Folkeparti, is rising in the polls, I'm not sure it's because of immigration. They're targeting Muslims, but they're targeting Muslim extremists as they have done for the last 10, 15 years. Integration is that there are hopeful signs that it's beginning to work in Denmark.
A man in Denmark, Michael Booth, thank you very much indeed for joining us. We can cross now to Toronto to hear from Chris Frey. Chris, we've just been hearing about a closed door policy in Denmark. It's been practically the opposite to where you are for the past few years, hasn't it?
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess it would be best characterized as generous, although the immigration system itself had become somewhat dysfunctional. Just looking at the backlog of applicants, for example, that you found waiting overseas for 3, 4, and 5 years, and sometimes even more, to have their, you know, to have their applications processed or refugee claims processed. So the Conservative government, which has been in power for the last 5 years or so, inherited, yes, a very generous regime, one that I think Canadians generally would agree has been profitable for the country. I mean, you don't have the kind of waves of anti-immigration sentiment you'd find in many other places. For the most part, I think, you know, despite our debates about multiculturalism and how relevant it remains as an official policy, you know, you don't see the kind of clashes and conflicts you would see in Europe, for example.
And can you explain why that is the case, Chris?
Oh, well, boy, I don't, you know, this is a funny thing, you know, countries often look to Canada to see how well multiculturalistic policies have succeeded. And we ourselves have these debates about them. And yet I think de facto on the ground, whether it's just, you know, time and you have generations of kids who go to school together and, you know, and eventually marry, for example, that there's just this closeness and familiarity that in a city like Toronto, we're staggering, like more than 50% of the population was born outside of the country, that you just don't see these kind of divisions. You will find, obviously, certain groups who come to Canada that face greater challenges than others. And there's certainly institutional racism at certain levels or residue of it. But by and large, I mean, the Canadian experiment, I don't know how well it's applicable to other countries. I don't know whether it is at all, because I think, in essence, Canada is a young country, a much younger country than, obviously, European ones and even the United States. And so I think in this, you know, this fulcrum of creation, it's an inherent part of the country's identity. Even going back to its origins, you know, there were originally First Nations or Aboriginals here, but it was founded as a, you know, the project between the French and the English. So it's kind of built into our DNA, I think, this level of accommodation and acceptance.
In Toronto, Chris Frey, thank you very much indeed. And before that, we heard from Michael Booth in Copenhagen and Aisha Spears in New York. Listening to that was Monocle's foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield. He joins me in the studio now. Steve, what interested me there about Chris Frey's comment is the youthfulness of a country generally promotes a more open mind towards integration.
It can do, yes. And I think Canada and the US are traditionally good examples of societies that were built by migrants. But we're living in an interesting age, because you know, the world has never been more international in the sense that we've never been more as interdependent as we are on each other at the moment. It's never been as easy as it is to travel to different countries. We've never known as much as we know now about other countries all over the world. There's no way that a British Prime Minister, as Neville Chamberlain did in 1939, would be able to say of Czechoslovakia, if it still existed, it's a faraway place with people of whom we know very little. And yet, despite all that, we're also, partly because of the economic times we're in, living in a period where there's a very strong fear of the outsider, despite all this. And it's odd in the sense that it's the idea of the outsider rather than the outsider themselves. When you look at parts of the UK where there have been concerns about immigration, there are often towns where there aren't actually that many migrants. London, for example, has huge numbers of migrants. That's where UKIP, the anti-immigrant party you mentioned before, really struggles because people live alongside lots of people from different cultures. So it's these odd paradoxes in all these different cases.
What's always astonished me in any debate involving immigration is the level of bad blood which manifests itself politically. It never seems to be a question of policy. It always seems to be a battle over a country's identity.
Yes, and I think, again, it's interesting, you know, with many politicians, they understand and accept the economic arguments of why countries need migrants. And so, for example, here in the UK, there's been lots of talk recently about benefit tourism, people coming here for our generous benefit system. Well, anyone who's been on benefits will understand that they're not really that generous. But if you look at the economics, Britain gains more in taxes from migrants who come here and work than it spends on public services for those migrants and others who don't work. So there's this disconnect between the economics and the politics. It's a very hard sell to say, you know, particularly, you know, if you're nice and middle class and you can, this is great, I can have a Polish plumber. If you are, if you are in the construction trade yourself, then you are going to be more than a little annoyed that, you know, Polish builders, for example, have been coming here, in your mind, taking your jobs.
What I find quite astonishing as well, though, is let's take the example of the UK Home Secretary Theresa May this week saying that they should curb visas for Brazilians. You can tell she is pandering, well, not pandering, she's speaking entirely to a section of the population which recognises that Brazilians have, I think it's the fifth largest number of immigrants into the country come from Brazil. They have the fifth, they have a big problem in terms of illegal immigration. Yet to what degree is Mrs. May not necessarily mindful of the fact that trade and investment in Brazil is such a key part of a government's international role?
She does understand that, and I think basically their big problem here is that Britain is a member of the European Union. As a member of the European Union, you have to let people travel freely. And so, you know, just as there are, you know, lots of people from other European countries in Britain, there are 750,000 Brits living in Spain, most of whom don't speak Spanish, most of whom are quite happy to use Spanish services, most of whom would be quite annoyed if all of a sudden Spain said, you know what, you guys speak Spanish or get out of here. But they've got themselves into a pickle politically because they've said, we will reduce immigration. They can't do that, because you can't stop people in the European Union coming. So they've done two things. One is like this with the Brazilians, and because that's an easy target. The other is with students, international students. And so that's adversely affected the way that the Britain's universities, which are some of the best in the world, can attract foreign students.
Which, of course, helps with funding.
And their money, which makes it easier for British students. So they've got themselves in a real pickle because they can't find the language to sell migration to the British population.
And of course, the Labour today has come out with the opposite argument, saying that it wants to renegotiate the immigration process from within Europe. I mean, that is a debate that I'm afraid we're going to have to leave for another day, because it will take forever to try and unpick free movement of persons.
One thing just to end is, look, we are all, most of us are from somewhere else, you know, at some stage. And I must say, there is something slightly delicious about people like Bill O'Reilly in the US railing against migrants when his surname is O'Reilly, and the mayor of Peterborough here in the UK who was complaining about the number of migrants, and he has an Italian surname. So there are always migrants. They become part of the country, and then they moan about the new migrants.
Our foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield, thank you very much indeed for joining us here in the studio. Before that, my thanks to Aisha Spears in New York, Chris Frey in Toronto and Michael Booth in Copenhagen. You're with Midori House. Coming up, the latest in the war of words over North Korea's nuclear capabilities. Stay with us.
Monocle Magazine is an essential monthly briefing of affairs, business, culture, design and travel. For £90 sterling, we'll deliver the whole year round to your home, regardless of where that might be. That's 10 issues, plus our summer and winter newspapers, Mediterraneo and Alpino. And our exclusive Monocle tote bag, designed by our creative team. Plus, all annual subscriptions allow you access to our extensive online archive. So subscribe today for a year of essential briefings. Monocle, keeping an eye on the world.
You're back with Midori House here on Monocle 24, where the time is approaching 21 minutes past the hour. Now, the UN Security Council has approved fresh sanctions against North Korea after its third nuclear test last month. In response, Pyongyang has ramped up its rhetoric, vowing to exercise the right to launch a preemptive nuclear attack against anybody considered to be an aggressor. North Korea has accused the United States of pushing to start a war. Earlier this week, it threatened to scrap the 60-year truce which ended the Korean War. Earlier on today, Louise Beale spoke to Aidan Foston Carter, who's honorary senior research fellow in sociology and modern Korea from Leeds University.
Is this all just talk, or are tensions really rising?
I think it's a bit of both. North Korea has always been renowned for extraordinarily virulent rhetoric, but it's in the past it was sort of more carefully calibrated, and some of it is pretty wild right now. One has to make distinctions. The threat to scrap the armistice has been made several times before in the past. I don't rate too much highly on that. And likewise, I don't take literally, you'll be pleased to hear, the one that you cited. I mean, it's just extraordinary ravings, isn't it, really, that you've reserved the right to preemptively have a nuclear strike on anybody you think might be going to do something to you. The new uncertainty, in my judgment, is that Kim Jong-un is in charge. I mean, this sounds like... Now, this is a hypothesis. It sounds like a kid, you know, one moment you embrace a clapped-out former basketball player and the next minute you threaten to shoot everybody. It's really hard to know what the message is, other than that we have to be on our guard.
Indeed we do. And as you say, some of the talk is quite frightening, really, but it could just obviously be talk. Obviously, both North and South Korea, they're involved in military drills at the moment, both sides are saying that they're, you know, that's provocative. What's the sort of impact or kind of significance of those?
Again, that I would file under, theoretically at least, would file it under special pleading. The exercise is full legal key resolve, which the US and South Korea undertake jointly every year. They've done it for years and years. Half of it's on computers anyway. It's small-scale stuff. And as far as I'm aware, there are no big changes this year that would make the North have any genuine ground to be afraid. On the other hand, unfortunately, precedent shows that we do have ground ourselves to be genuinely afraid when they say this stuff. Back in 2010, when again the South Koreans were doing some quite routine shelling, admittedly on islands they control, which are very near the North Korean coast, but it's stuff that happens all the time. The North Koreans did retaliate, as they would see it, and they did fire a shell that landed on an island and killed four people. So, I mean, there will be extra vigilance, definitely, at the moment.
As for the sanctions themselves, what are we expecting to see? What kind of sanctions are these going to be, and what kind of impact?
It does sound as if they go further than past sanctions. I mean, I suppose, in a way, we're running out of stuff to sanction in a fairly sort of semi-closed, it's a closed economy, it plays its cards close to its chest anyway, because this will be the fourth time, and they've been after previous nuclear tests and missile tests and so on. But it looks as if, whereas until quite recently, China and Russia, which tend to sort of vaguely fight North Korea's corner, or at least say we shouldn't paint them into a corner and so on, we're always saying, no, it's got to be stuff that's specifically related to the nuclear program and the missile program. The talk this time is that it goes further, and that luxury goods trade, which already is banned, admittedly, that there will be more intrusive inspections. In fact, by one account, which I think may be exaggerated, we'll see. I mean, everybody, which would include China, commits themselves to inspect all cargoes going to and from North Korea. That would lead to considerable queues on the bridge across the Yalu River from Dandong, if that were true. And somehow I doubt that. And also looking at sort of financial measures and their financial networks, which have in the past have been linked to state crime. So this does take it a bit further. And if the North Koreans are cross now, they're going to go ballistic. I hope that's only a metaphor when the actual resolution goes through.
Indeed. And just finally, Australia have put plans to open a North Korean embassy on hold. What's the significance of that?
This is... I tweeted, I'm afraid, slightly ironically, the thing that will really bring the North Koreans to their senses, being deprived of the chance of living in Canberra. But more seriously, there's a 40-year history of on-off. The Australians opened up in 74, 75. The North Koreans thought this was a great coup at the time, and then the North Koreans suddenly kicked them out, and the North Koreans suddenly left Canberra all those years ago. They came back. They left again, citing lack of money and so on. So it's not a huge deal, really. But it shows up in a way how little impact the rest of us have. But yeah, at the time when they're behaving like this and chucking their toys out of the pram all the time, who wants to have them as house guests?
And that was Aidan Foster-Carter, Honorary Senior Research Fellow in Sociology and Modern Korea from Leeds University, talking to Louise Beale a little earlier on Monocle 24. Now, Milan's cobbled streets have never been the most comfortable to walk on, yet that's never stopped any Milanese worth his or her footwear from clip-clopping with considerable panache. And more than 1,500 exhibitors have been in the city this week for MICAM, the Italian footwear show. Well, joining me on the line now from Milan is Diego Rossetti, who runs a second-generation luxury shoe brand, Fratelli Rossetti. A very warm welcome to the programme, Diego. You've been to the fair. What was it like this year?
Yeah, good evening to everybody. It was a great show. It was we had a great attendance, especially from the Far East and North America and South America. So we really have been very, very pleased.
You mentioned new customers from the Far East. Is this where your new generation of customers is coming from?
Well, you know, China is a new market and it's really booming. There is a new generation of Chinese that are really looking for real Italian quality that don't necessarily have to be very well known as, you know, the luxury brands that everybody knows. But they really want something that is really Italian, and they're very conscious about the quality of the products they sell, they buy.
And that considered, how strong is the brand Made in Italy now, given the fact that it can sometimes not stand for great quality?
Made in Italy is a great brand because and the only possibility that we Italians have to really protect this brand is to make quality products. When you see products that are branded made in Italy that are not quality, chances are that they are counterfeited. That's why we are struggling very hard within the European community to make the made in compulsory on every product that is imported into Europe.
In the last few weeks and months, we've experienced, well, we've witnessed chaos in the Italian political field. And we're also hearing stories of a brain drain of Milanese, especially artisans, leaving the country because there are simply no longer any jobs. How has that affected the atmosphere at MICAM this year? Is there confidence in the Italian brand?
Well, we Italians are optimistic by nature. So, I mean, we have gone through many political turmoils over the years, and this is not going to scare us more than the others. It is true that it's a very complicated situation, but the good thing about it is that, that there is been and there will be a major change in the political ruling class. So, I mean, let's see the glass half full.
Fratelli Rossetti is what, 50 years old this year? It was your father's business, I understand. That obviously benefits from the idea of tradition, but have you seen any new manufacturers, new brands coming up this year at MICAM?
Well, there are a lot of Italian shoe manufacturers that maybe, as I was saying before, they're not very well known, but they actually make great products. So, there are plenty that are present at the MICAM.
Diego Rossetti from Fratelli Rossetti, thank you very much indeed for joining us. That was Diego Rossetti talking to us from Milan. You're listening to Midori House. In the next half hour of today's programme, we'll examine a side to Arab life that's traditionally kept under wraps, and we'll ask if anyone can buy art, and we'll take lunch with the Financial Times.
When we had the idea of doing this as a book, I thought it was a dreadful idea. I thought that the whole business of, you know, newspapers is it's transient. It's not pretending to be anything more than that. And so why on earth would you want to read an interview from 1996, for God's sake?
We'll be hearing a little more from Lucy Kellaway later on in today's programme. But first, with the time at 30 minutes past the hour, let's get the latest world headlines now from Paul.
The head of the Independent Commission overseeing Kenya's presidential election has denied allegations of ballot rigging. The running mate of one leading candidate, Raila Odinga, says that the votes have been doctored. More than 1,000 people died in violence after the last presidential election in Kenya when Mr. Odinga claimed he'd been robbed of victory. The UN Security Council has agreed new sanctions against North Korea. It follows the country's latest nuclear test. It's the fourth set of sanctions, this time targeting cash transfers and the activities of North Korean diplomats. A son-in-law of Osama bin Laden has been detained in Jordan in an operation involving the FBI. He'd appeared in videos after the September 11th attacks praising them. It's not clear yet if he'll be sent to the United States to stand trial before an American court. Silvio Berlusconi has been sentenced to a year in prison after being convicted in connection with an illegal wiretap. But the former Italian Prime Minister remains a free man. He's likely to launch an appeal. And the detective who was put in charge of the investigation into Oscar Pistorius has resigned from the South African police force. Hilton Butter was removed from the case after it emerged that he himself was facing charges of attempted murder. And those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24. London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24. London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24. London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24. London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24. This is Monocle 24. London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
And you're back with Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Emma Nelson. Now, my next guest is an award-winning journalist whose latest book, Sex and the Citadel, explores an area of Arab life traditionally kept from public view. Shireen El Fekki was a veteran of the Tahrir Square protests. Her book is the culmination of 5 years' research across the Middle East to find out where sexuality lies within the region. The result is astonishing. And I'm delighted to say Shireen joins me in the studio. A very warm welcome to Midori House, Shireen.
Thank you, Emma.
First and foremost, what prompted you to want to explore sexuality within the Middle East?
Well, it was personal and professional. So my personal background, I grew up in Canada, but my origins are Egyptian. My father is Egyptian. My family is in Egypt. I have an Egyptian passport. I'm Muslim. But I never really thought about my Arab heritage until September 11th. And that changed everything for me. And I wanted to know more about where I came from. The professional side is that my background is in HIV/AIDS. I trained as an immunologist. I was healthcare correspondent at The Economist magazine, and I was also vice chair of the Global Commission on HIV and the Law. And I became interested in HIV in the Arab world, and to understand HIV, you have to look at sex. And through looking at sex and sexuality more broadly, I realized that it gave me an insight not just into intimate life, but into the broader political, economic, social conditions, history, religion, generations, gender. It's this incredibly powerful lens.
And how welcome were you when you went on this journey exploring sexuality? Because it is a subject which is so off limits.
in many ways and to many people. The fact that you had a public health background and the fact that you had both a Canadian, Welsh and Egyptian heritage as well, did that help or hinder you at all?
Well, diversity can often be an asset. And you're right. Certainly, it's much easier to talk about sexuality when you put a white coat on it. So you enter through public health. But really, what helped me was my insider and outsider status. So as an insider, someone who has a connection to the region, people, and particularly women, were very much more comfortable talking to me because they realized I knew where they were coming from. But you're looking at me right now. I have all the fair features of my Welsh mother, you know, my figure is quite frankly more Arrow than arabesque. And that was actually an asset because very often people, and particularly women, feel constrained in talking about sex in public, for example, because they fear that they're going to be judged. But people looked at me and thought, ah, here's someone who comes from the West, and they have stereotypes about the West as being a sort of sexual free-for-all. And that actually helped me because they thought I wouldn't judge them. And that's exactly what happened. I went in, I wanted to listen, I had a connection, but there was no judgment. And really, I hope that tone comes through in the book. I am presenting their voices and letting them speak for themselves because their stories are really compelling, both their stories of problems, but also the stories of how they're trying to find solutions.
It is an astonishing book insofar as, like you say, there is a very strong voice that comes out from women in the region. And they have a very strong sense of sexuality and sense of self. Yet there is this overwhelming cultural blanket that is spread over them, physically in terms of in many places where the fact that they are, you know, not allowed to show their figures. But also they're not allowed to speak out and have their own kind of sexual identity as Western women just take for granted.
But you know, it's interesting, Emma, and this was really brought home to me by a woman, a queer activist in Beirut. You're talking about a sexual identity. And she said to me, look, how can I have a sexual identity when I don't have an individual identity? I exist as part of my family or my tribe or my community. On the government records, I am the daughter of my father. And when I get married, I'm going to be the wife of a husband. How do you expect me to have a sexual identity? And so it's a different conception than you find in the West.
What's been your take then on the recent events in the Middle East? I'm speaking about the Arab Spring, and I'm talking about the stories that emerge from the likes of Egypt, which say that although there is a very, very problematic attempt to bring democracy to the country, the treatment of women, especially in public, is getting almost unbearable.
Well, look, sex is a tool of control no matter where you are in the world. And you're basically alluding to, for example, the attacks on women in Tahrir Square, or indeed the incidents of rape we're seeing in the Syrian civil war. And sex is a particularly powerful tool of control in a patriarchy, in the Arab world, because it's also connected with shame. So if you want to cause maximum confusion in society, go after women sexually. Because not only do you impugn their honor, but because what I was saying about the individual and the collective, you're also attacking the family honor and the honor of their menfolk as well. Just because we have got rid of the father of the nation, be it Mubarak or Ben Ali, doesn't mean the patriarchy has gone away. And that sort of very heavy top-down system causes all sorts of ructions in society, and very often in these drip, drip, drip situations of sexual harassment, which were occurring before the uprisings. Many experts have posited, and I think there's a point here, that men are under pressure too. Poor men, uneducated men, men without possibilities. And when men are under pressure in a patriarchy, they lash out at the next people down the line, and they are women. The question really moving forward in the connection between the political and the sexual really is to say, look, millions of people are aspiring for justice and freedom and equality and dignity. But if we don't achieve those in our personal lives and in the bedroom, how do we expect to get those in public life?
I mean, conversely, you argue in your book that political freedom will only come once you have, you know, personal freedom, the likes of which you've just been talking about, freedom within a family unit. How realistic do you actually think that prospect is?
Look, we're not looking at a sexual revolution here, okay? We don't even have a political revolution. We have new governments, new actors, but essentially business as usual, only without the tools of enforcement of the old regime. Sex is so complex, that change is going to occur over a long period of time. But yes, you can see change happening. For example, in these recent incidents of sexual assault, that women are actually speaking out and saying, you know what, I was attacked. This is unprecedented, really. 10 years ago, you would never have heard that. And not only are they saying, I was sexually assaulted, but it is my right to protest. And they go on television and their husbands are sitting beside them. And they say, you know what, this is wrong, this is against Islam, and this is my wife's right. And the fact that in the square, you find NGOs working, it's not easy for them, it was hard under the old climate, hard under the new climate, but they're together trying to provide services for women and information. And guess what? There are young men and young women working together. This is what gives me hope.
And very briefly, finally, Shireen, the book, I have a copy of it in my hand, it's in English. To what degree are you hopeful that in Arabic this will be widely read? Who do you hope to read this?
Okay, you know when I'll know when my job is done? When, let's say 5 years from now, I go into the home of Azza, one of the women I talk about in the book, whose life and the life of her family illuminated the problems of marriage. If I go into her home and I see that book in Arabic in her living room, and more to the point, I see her daughter, her teenage daughter by that point, who is on my website, sexinthecitadel.com, and she's not only reading it, she's contributing to it, then all the change I talk about will be on its way, and I will have considered that my book had helped make the change.
Shireen El-Fekky, author of Sex and the Citadel, thank you very much indeed for joining us. You're listening to Midori House. Stay with us, because in a moment we take lunch with the FT.
If we use, dear listeners, the metaphor of Monocle 24 as an online radio amusement park, then Culture with me, Robert Bound, is the roller coaster.
We are finally on the train, on the sexy contemporary art train.
Scaling the heights of artistic endeavour to look out across a picturesque international landscape dotted with galleries, live music venues, outdoor screenings of wonderful movies being scrutinised and applauded by appreciative audiences. Marvel at the view. Strap yourself in. Scream, ladies and gentlemen, if you want to go faster. We're just one metaphor away from a meltdown. On the latest edition, we ask how you export Saudi Arabian art. We go all the way to Ouagadougou just to watch films, and we hang out with that funk soul brother, Jamie Liddell.
I always wanted to live in Nashville because you can, you know, this is a place where you can do stuff, you can really create, and you don't get distractions.
That's Culture with Robert Bound, premiering every Monday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
Review is Monocle 24's weekly review and preview of the arts. Every Saturday, we take a relaxed look back at the books, TV shows, films, music, theatre, and events that have made our week, while looking around the corner to scout out the next big thing.
It doesn't feel sappy, it doesn't feel sentimental, it does have a certain heft.
It's very Darwinian. The shows that do well run and the ones that don't close, and there have been some quite high-profile flops and some great successes as well.
For me, it's riotous, it's tasteless, but it's actually dynamic as well, it has momentum.
Join Monocle's editors as they sit down with our favourite critics, opinion makers and key industry figures for some in-depth discussion and lively debate. And we provide inspiration for the weekend from cities around the world.
It's a real divider because I know some people just love this film and other people really just hate it.
That's a review every Saturday at midday London time and across the weekend, right here on Monocle 24.
And you're back with Midori House, where the time here in London is just approaching 18:44. Up next, we have a little bit of lunch with the Financial Times, but to give us a little bit of an appetite, here's Food for My Soul by The Dragons. And that was Food for My Soul by The Dragons. Now, you're listening to Midori House. The time is 18:46 here in London. And we heard from our foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield, just a little earlier on in the programme on the weighty issue of immigration. We can hear him now again as he tackles a more light-hearted subject. Lunch with the FT has been a weekly column in the Financial Times for almost two decades. The idea is simple. The reader has a chance to sit at the same table for lunch with some of the most influential and interesting people on the planet. A book has now been issued, Lunch with the FT. It's a collection of interviews stretching all the way back to 1994. Monocle's foreign editor Steve Bloomfield caught up with the Financial Times' Lucy Kellaway for an afternoon chat here at Midori House to talk about Lunch with the FT.
Now, I must say, on a Saturday morning when I get the FT, the first thing I turn to is Lunch with the FT, regardless of who it is being interviewed. And it's, what is it that you think, you know, makes it quite so special and that sort of that go-to page for so many readers?
Yeah, I think we sort of stumbled on this by accident, but it seems that this is the perfect way of doing an interview. It's because the lunch frames the anecdote. So it's not a sort of baggy, directionless sort of interview profile, but the lunch gives it a very clear beginning, middle and end. But also because it's lunch, it's not the sort of interrogation question and answer. It's much, much more convivial. So that means that you can have sort of broader discussions. It means with any luck, the interviewee is going to be a bit more relaxed. And it also means, you know, when I do them, that I love sort of commenting on how people eat, how they use their knives and forks.
Because
that can quite
that.
Often, yeah, ahem. I mean, that can quite often be as revealing as what it is that they say.
And it's interesting as well that that they're the ones that choose where they want to eat. And that, you know, is always obviously a reflection of their personality or at least what they like. The side of their personality they want to perhaps portray that day.
Exactly. So it's as much the sort of, you know, the spun thing of what, you know, where would it be good to be seen to eat. So that quite often plays a part. But it's not only where they eat, it's what they eat and how much they drink too. I mean, in the old, when we started doing this series, people were much happier to sort of have at least a bottle of wine than they are now.
I'm glad you mentioned that. Because I must say, that's the one thing I've noticed is people don't drink at lunch anymore. In for lunch with the FT, anyhow, is that because you think they're a little bit nervous about getting drunk and saying the wrong thing, or is that a reflection of the fact that, you know, less people perhaps drink at lunch these days?
Yeah, I think it's a bit of both. It's a bit of both. And I mean, one of the cutest things about this, which I really like and works as a design detail, is we always sort of print, as it were, a sort of facsimile of the bill on it so that you can sort of, it's very, very clear to the reader how much has been drunk. And our more convivial readers rather approve of people drinking at lunchtime, but still, I don't think that's the view of the PR world, who would advise to stick with the Virgin Marys and the sparkling water.
I must say, though, some of the most memorable, and you've got a very good choice in this book, but one that I would have really liked to see, and perhaps you can put in the next edition, was the interview with DBC Pierre, where he basically just got rat-arsed, didn't he?
He did. He really, really did, to put it politely. That was a fantastic one. And I mean, I think that some of the ones in this book I probably wouldn't have chosen if I was editing it. And some of the other ones that I remember, I would. But one thing that really strikes me is that when we had the idea of doing this as a book, I thought it was a dreadful idea. I thought that the whole business of, you know, newspapers is it's transient. It's not pretending to be anything more than that. And so why on earth would you want to read an interview from 1996, for God's sake, or, you know, from that's just when sort of time has moved on. But what I'm amazed by is that reading these now, even the ones that are sort of nearly 20 years old, I find that I enjoy them just as much, if not more, than I did the first time. And I mean, just I was just sort of thinking while I was waiting to do this interview, I was reading again the wonderful one that we did with the Saudi prince who's recently been complaining to Forbes.
Prince Al-Waleed.
Exactly, that he's not high up enough on their rich list. And reading back the interview that he did then in the Georges V Hotel, which of course he owns, he was sort of saying, oh, you know, being rich didn't matter to him at all. It was all about giving the money away. And so when you read those
things... He's changed
his
tune somewhat now.
Yeah, and so that's lovely, having the sort of historical perspective.
Well, talking of the historical perspective, there's a really fascinating interview with Saif Gaddafi from September 2004, which really shows, obviously his situation has somewhat changed.
Yes,
now from a time when he was having sweet mint tea, a basket of fruit, melon and watermelon cubes and dates. With a glass of buttermilk.
I know, but that gives it a sort of poignancy in a way that sort of time moves on. But I mean, that was a beautifully written anecdote and a lovely piece of work. So I think that when time has moved on like that, rather than sort of obliterating the point of the interview, it gives it more point in a way.
Of the ones that you've done yourself, which ones particularly stand out for good or bad reasons?
There was one that I did that I can't believe that they put in with Zaha Hadid, who's very, very difficult to interview. And I thought I did a sort of reasonably boring workman-like job, so I nearly fell over when that had been included. But there's one in the collection that I really, really am proud of, and that was with Jacques Attali. And mainly why I was proud of it was how I got the interview. I sort of thought, well, he's probably the sort of man who sort of paves the entrance of the bank and marble, who's sufficiently vain to do that, can probably be talked over. But don't forget, it was the FT that cost him his job. So if I was him, I wouldn't, I would never want to speak to the FT again. But I sent him a letter just sort of saying, how we really wanted to talk to him about him being such a sort of marvellous philosopher and sort of general grovel, fawn. to my amazement, on the double, he would be absolutely delighted to have lunch with the FT. So I scurried over to Paris and he talked to me about his extraordinary philosophical ideas and I just wrote them down. There was no need for further commentary. So sometimes like that, the article writes itself and that's always a particular joy and readers can take it in whatever way they choose to.
And that was Lucy Kellaway from the Financial Times talking to Steve Bloomfield a little earlier on. And I can heartily recommend the Lunch with the FT interview with DBC Pierre, where an awful lot of tequila is drunk. You're listening to Majori House with me, Emma Nelson. Now, buying art is a complicated process. It can also be rather expensive. And while many of us would dearly love to hang a Miro in our hall or a Picasso in our bedroom, life doesn't always happen that way. However, an art fair, which begins this weekend in London, aims to open the doors to art lovers whose pockets don't generally go deep enough to afford art. At the Affordable Art Fair, nothing costs more than £4,000. That's around $6,000. So what will this do for the lower end of the art market? Are we now at the stage of art for all? Tonight's the official launch of the London event being held this weekend in Battersea. Joining me from the fair is a director of the event, Nikki. Welcome to the programme. Nikki, what kind of customers are you expecting at the fair this weekend?
Actually, the fair is really, it really is art for all. So we get everyone from kind of young, first-time buyers looking perhaps for their first sort of small piece of art for their new home, right through to, grannies who are looking to buy something maybe for their grandchildren, and, everyone in between. I mean, the work really, veers from the kind of cool and edgy, right through to much more traditional work, seascapes, baskets of fruit, what have you. And there's really something for everybody here. And that was very much our aim when we set out to launch the fair back in 1999.
How do you go about buying a piece of art which is at the low end of the market and perhaps which might not have the cash in the provenance of slightly pricier items?
Well, all the work here is, there will certainly be provenance because all the work is being bought from a gallery who's representing the artist. So it's, without a doubt, it's original art. But I would say that the most important thing when you're looking to buy a piece of art is to actually buy something that you love. It's really not about, buying what your neighbours have bought. It's buying something that perhaps reflects your personality, maybe kind of reflects your interests. But it's something that you really love and you do want to put on your wall and look at for a long time. I mean, yes, without a doubt, there are people coming here looking for an investment and obviously there are different ways to do that. But at the end of the day, I would still always say, buy something because you really want to look at it.
Given the fact that I can imagine that your vetting process is particularly strict when it comes to this kind of stuff, how much really good art is out there at less than £4,000 a go?
Well, we what what we were not about was selling cheap poor quality art. So even though the work has a ceiling on price of £4,000, we also want to ensure that it is quality work as well. So yes, indeed, there is a vetting process. And certainly people have bought work here over the years where the artist's work, you know, has the prices have rocketed. And I'm just sorry I didn't buy some of them. But quality is not an issue. It's very good quality. It just is affordable. And by that, we mean there is a ceiling on price. And when you come through the doors, everything does have a price on it. And, you know, one of our aims was to make it a less intimidating experience than some art fairs. So we do insist that everything has a price on it. The dealers here are all very friendly, very welcoming, and they're very happy to chat about their artist practice, perhaps give information about whether, you know, the artists have won any awards, whether they're in big collections. And I think asking questions about the artwork and about the artist is all sort of good to, you know, help inform you and help you make up your mind.
To what degree is this an art fair purely for the private collector? Do you also get a lot of dealers from the art world who are wandering around trying to pick up something that they can possibly at a later date mark up quite significantly?
I think more to the point, because a lot of the artists here are actually emerging artists. For example, we actually have an emerging artist showcase in the entrance marquee to the fair. It's curated by Jota. They're an online a group of organisation that represents emerging artists, and they've curated an amazing show. It looks absolutely stunning, and a lot of the work has sold already. So we do know that we're getting a lot of dealers coming here actually looking for the next big thing. And so yes, without a doubt, they are picking up, you know, some of our artists. And some of the artists that are shown here this week, you know, who knows where they're going to be in, you know, next year. But certainly some of them have gone on to command very big prices and are being represented by very important dealers.
Nikki Wheeler, thank you very much indeed for joining us. That was Nikki Wheeler, who's director of the Affordable Art Fair, talking to me from Battersea Park. The Affordable Art Fair is on at Battersea Park in London until the 10th of March. But if you can't make it, it is also on around the world in different forms during the rest of the year. That's all we have time for today's programme. My thanks to our producer, Phil Hun, and to our researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Barbara Feeney, and our studio manager, Ben Jay. Next up is The Urbanist, which this week is all about cars in the city. Among other automobile-related reports, we'll be finding out what the drivers of Moscow get up to in traffic jams. And in 3 hours' time at 2200 hours here in London, Andrew Muller and Gillian De Bias will be back for the Monocle Daily. In an hour's time, I'll be your host for the Pacific Shift. But for the time being, from me, Emma Nelson, goodbye. Thank you very much for listening.